You know, some people say hearing is the last sense to go when we die. So what is the last sound I get to hear at the end of my life? Is it like this?
Do you know that feeling when you try to really like get it in your bones that you're gonna die someday? It's impossible. What is that? What are you talking about?
You know what? I guess gay people can go camping and...
Those voices come from the first ever Reimagine End of Life, a week-long exploration of big questions about life and death through creativity and conversation. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, palliative care physician and host of Dying to Talk, KALW's program dedicated to tackling taboos around death and dying. In this hour, I'll bring you some of the highlights from the first Reimagine End of Life and invite you to take part as it returns with more than 150 events in every corner of San Francisco from April 16th to the 22nd. Reimagine End of Life was the brainchild of Brad Wolf, musician, design thinker, and producer with the design firm IDEO.
We designed Reimagine because even though death is something that affects all of us, it can still be a taboo to talk about it in our culture. It's messy and it's beautiful. And yeah, there is sadness, but within the sadness is love. And there may be tears, but there's also laughter. And we wanted the week to be a reflection of that idea.
2,000 people from infants to people in their 80s took part in the first Reimagine End of Life. Stay tuned to hear some of what they experienced. You'll be inspired to think differently about death and dying. And hopefully, to have conversations with the people you love about this universal human experience. Our first stop is at a Reimagine event called You're Going to Die, Poetry, Prose, and Everything Goes. You're Going to Die invites people to creatively and unabashedly confront loss and mortality. Here's its creator and host, Ned Buskirk.
Right when Vera Kocha was like kind of embracing the show and I was figuring out who I was and it had got named You're Going to Die, and I was very awkward about telling people that. It's like, what do you got going on this weekend? It's an open mic space. So you're immortal, right? Of course you're immortal. Anyway, you're going to die, and just nervous. You know, who the f*** calls an event You're Going to Die and then says it to people's faces confidently? I didn't for a long time, and now I'd probably say it too much. Too confidently. But you know what that shift was? That shift for me was my mother-in-law's death, was my wife's mother's death. When that loss happened, I had a show at Vera Kocha, and I got up on that stage, and I knew what I was supposed to do with that show. And I knew what I needed and what I wanted in that space. And from that show on, that's what this is. It's a space to gather together as community and be in the conversation of mortality, to be in the conversation of death and dying, to be in the conversation of grief and loss. And I'm never more clear that this is what I'm supposed to do than I am right now. Like, I don't care about anything else other than my family and my community than I do, like, about this thing, this movement, and what it is for me to have this outlet and what it is clearly for you. And I want to be clear about that, that my best measurement for knowing that this matters and it's worth doing and it works is because people need it. Because where else can you gather and just honestly be together in the heartbreak of the eventuality that is our death? And how often can you unabashedly share with each other in your losses that you keep inside you all day long, because I can't bring it up when I go to Bank of America to talk to the teller. I want to be like, hey, this money's ridiculous, right? It's paper. Don't get me wrong, I need to get some out right now because I have to go buy cauliflower. What's that? By the way. Anyway, my mom died in 2003. What are you up to these days? You know, like there's not a lot of space in life to just open that conversation out, and I get it, that's okay, but where do we get that? That's our job, to make that space. And I don't mean like a show like this, like all of you, go now, there is no show tonight. Go find a cafe, start your own, good night. No, I mean like,
yeah.
I should do that one night. One night I'm gonna do that. Hundreds of people show up, it's like, and now leave immediately and start your own show elsewhere. Thank you for paying to be here. What was I saying? The thing is that you can go out and be this in the world, like to be just willing to ask someone about the person that's died. And as hard as it is to talk to people when they've lost someone, to go forth knowing you're not supposed to have the answers, because who does? It's ridiculous. Death makes no sense at all. It's absurd. It is. I mean, really, do you know that feeling when you try to really like get it in your bones that you're going to die someday? It's impossible. What is that? What are you talking about? Where are you going then? What happens? What's my body do? You know, like after that? You know, I have no idea. I'm not here to offer that answer. But what I am here to do is like ask and be in the question and be with you tonight. And I am grateful to be here. And I'm grateful for all the performers that are going to get up to share what they have to share. Like, I really want to be clear that in my life and my year, this moment right now is tremendous. To have this show arrive here and have this audience, have all of you come out to be a part of this, it's blowing my mind. So the only thing I need you to do now is just say this phrase on the count of three. And the phrase is, I'm going to die. And really, it's just a way for me to kind of get off my chest that you're going to die and that I've been telling you that like constantly for a long, long time, and have you kind of take responsibility for it verbally, because it's true, and really, why not take responsibility for the truth? And again, let me just say, it's quote, I'm going to die, end quote. It's not like, don't yell at me, you're going to die, because I said... So on the count of three, ready? One, two, three. I'm going to die.
The AIDS epidemic of the 1980s made it impossible to ignore death, as hospitals filled with young people dying from mysterious diseases. In this story, For You're Going to Die, Ed Wolfe shares his revelation that grief is both terrible and beautiful. Prepare to laugh, then get your Kleenex ready.
Early 1980s, people with AIDS start appearing in San Francisco. And for those of you who weren't there or don't know, it's a very visible illness. You could see people And I, like many people in San Francisco, we got mobilized, and I became like a volunteer buddy for Shanti Project. And then I got a job working at San Francisco General on the AIDS unit there as like a grief counselor, working with all these young, primarily men who were dying and the people they were leaving behind. One of the things about dying of AIDS is that you become so emaciated, like you just don't have any flesh on your bones. And the hospital People would even be uncomfortable in a hospital bed. So the AIDS unit bought these incredible egg crate things. They would fit the bed. They were blue foam, but they were like 8 inches high, and they were like super comfortable, and people would just be so happy to be able to sleep. And when people would leave, they would take them home. And when people would die, they would be left behind. And I noticed, like, people, when someone dies in a hospital room, the body goes to the morgue and you get rid of their belongings and you roll up this blue thing and you put it out by the trash. And I was going home one night and I looked at it and I thought, wow, that would be an incredible thing to, like, take on a camping trip. So I have 7 sisters, and they used to love to go camping, and so one time I planned a whole trip, and they all came up, and I made, you know, I set up everyone's tent, gave everyone a pad, and everyone's, you know, so it's like Walton's Mountain, you know, we're all getting ready to go to sleep, and people are like, good night, Ed, good night, Nancy, good night, Betsy, and then one of my sisters go, God, Ed, these mats, they're incredible. Where did you get them? And I said, well, they knew I worked in a hospital. And I said, well, I get them at the hospital. And one of my other sisters said, well, I don't understand it. Like, why wouldn't someone just take this home with them? And I said, well, when the patients do go home, they take it with them. So there's this, like, this long pause. I can see my 7 sisters are in their 7 tents. Finally, one of them went, oh my God. And one of the other ones went, gross. So in the morning, we got up and we had breakfast. We had a little breakfast circle, and we talked about it. And one of my sisters named these things the little blue launching pad. Here's the thing about being alive in an epidemic. Besides constantly talking to each other about who's sick or who's dying or who's about to die, or, you know, because the AIDS epidemic, it wasn't just you working with patients. It was your neighbors and the people at the bank and your partners. Like, everyone was so sick. So one of the big themes was, like, what are you doing to take care of yourself? What do you do, like, in a city that's like a MASH unit at times? What do you do to take care of yourself? So I was already gotten in the habit of saying, well, I go to this place up in the mountains on the Yuba River. And so people would sometimes express interest in it, especially gay men that I know who had AIDS. And they'd say, well, I'd like to go there. And these were like gay men who, like, had never been camping or maybe hadn't been in a while. And so I used to do these camping trips. I've got a lot of stories about all of them, but I'm just going to tell one story about one of them that encapsulated it all. His name was Ronnie, and like many gay men, especially of that era, he had been kicked out by his family, and he had a terrible KS, which is a skin condition that people with AIDS get when their immune system is gone. And his KS took this shape of, like, these, almost like these little mushrooms on his skin. And he was so self-conscious about it. Even up at the Yuba River in the hot, hot weather of July, he would have everything covered because he was so self-conscious. So we went hiking one day along the river, and this log had floated up. It was laying on the thing. I'll never forget it. It was covered with mushrooms. Like the most incredible mushrooms. And we were all going, oh my God, look at that. So beautiful. look at that one, look at that one. And then Ronnie, he just very quickly just took all his clothes off and laid down next to the log. And he said, are mine beautiful? And, you know, we said, yes, yes, they are. And then, like, it freed him somehow. It freed him somehow, like the natural world can free you if you can find a way to enter it. When he got really, really sick, he actually died. He died on the unit at 5A. He let us know that he would like us to take his ashes and bring them to the Yuba River. And so when he died, we did that. We took them up there. He was in love with Out of Africa, with Meryl Streep and Robert Redford. He loved the soundtrack. So he asked, please bring a boombox. And when you spread my ashes, play this one song. See a way, a way, see a way, a way, a way, see a way, a way, a way, see a way. So we played that, and we spread his ashes. If you've ever done something like that, it's like, it's so terrible, and it's so beautiful at the same time. It's both. It's both. And then the treatments came, and people stopped dying, and we didn't have to spread ashes anymore. But I always went back there. I had this epiphany, and it's like the most powerful epiphanies are so simple, right? I looked into the fire and I realized, oh my God, one day people are gonna come down that road, park their car, they're gonna have a little box, and I'm gonna be in it, you know? And they're gonna take me into that sacred pond, gonna pour me into it. I'm gonna go down the river into Lake Spalding, the main fork of the Yuba, the American River, out through the delta where the salmon are trying to get up through there, you know, into the bay, out under the Golden Gate, out into the sea, right? Where the ocean denies no river, right? The ocean denies no river. And I have to put this in writing so that someone will remember this. When they take me into that pond, I want them to bring a boombox. I want them to bring the soundtrack of Out of Africa. I want, as they set me free, I want someone to hit the play button so they all hear. See a way, a way, a see a way, a way, a way, yeah. See a way, a way, a way, see a way.
That's Ed Wolfe telling his story on the You're Going to Die stage at the first ever Reimagine End of Life. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, and this is a special broadcast featuring highlights from Reimagine End of Life, which returns to San Francisco from April 16th to 22nd, with a full week of events drawing on arts, spirituality, healthcare, and design. Explore more than 150 events at letsreimagine.org. Death happens in many ways, from an illness progressing to natural causes to sudden death, which itself can take many forms. The next artist at You're Going to Die, Angela Hennessy, uses poetry to reflect on her own experience of facing sudden death.
My name is Angela Hennessy. I am a survivor of gun violence. I was shot on the front steps of my house just about a year ago. Someone tried to kill me. I think if someone shoots at you one, two, 3, 4 times. That means they're trying to kill you. If they look you in the eye and you look down the black hole barrel of the gun and then they still shoot you, I think that means they're trying to kill you. Through and through, that's what they call it when the bullet goes in one side of you and comes out the other. I was standing barefoot in my own blood. It was like I saw my own death. I saw my own funeral. I saw it in their eyes, the people who love me, my friends, my family, my mother, my son, who asked me if I was going to die. Not today. That's what I said, not today. As if my ancestors are listening. This is an entry wound, an exit wound, a cry, a sob, a scream, a rant, a prayer, a conjuring, a libation, a visitation, a manifesto. It is ex voto from a vow. The School of the Dead. 1, we are all students, and death is our teacher. 2, death knows everything about everything, but doesn't give any answers. It's okay to be curious, to fantasize about death, to think that death has or is the answer. Death asks questions like, are you living or are you dying? And when does dying begin? And what is the difference between dying and being killed? 3. Death teaches the life class, which has already begun, regardless of your arrival, your attention, your readiness, your sharpened number 2 pencils, your fully charged devices. There are no prerequisites. The assignments are complex in their simplicity, and the syllabus is always being revised. 1 minute, everything is all metaphor and symbol, and then suddenly, there is a body. 1 minute you are writing a poem, and the next you are filling out a death certificate. 4. Death appears in many forms and has many faces. You may or may not recognize death. It is possible you have never met. Death denial is alive and well, and this may be all you have ever known. It may be that you are among the numerous cases of death amnesia, a symptom of death-phobic culture. Side effects may include the inability to recognize death or to remember the inevitability of your own death, the causal effect being the attempt to live a life uninformed by death. Immortality narratives and biomedical technologies of life extension and preservation may further obscure the teachings of death, resulting in death. Would you make a portrait or take a mugshot of death? Would death sport a hoodie, a halo, a cape, a gun? Who is death to you? 5. There is always a body. It could be the body of someone you loved. It could be the body of someone you didn't even know. It could be your own body after somebody left you for dead. Perhaps they didn't actually die, you didn't actually die, but still you feel dead inside. 6. Did you kiss the dead body? 7. Too many of the dead are left unnamed, unclaimed, neutralized by statistics, diminished by anonymity and censorship in the theft and trafficking of bodies, the death march of forced migration, assimilation, intergenerational violence, and injury. Death is not a spectacle. Death does not YouTube, Facebook, Tumble, Instagram, Regram, LinkedIn, Blab, Blog, Vine, Kick, Snap, or Tweet. Death doesn't need an app. Death will not be televised. Death will be live. 8. The privatization of grieving undermines and underestimates the basic function of being witnessed in the unattended sorrows of being alive. We swallow, naively surrendering to misguided inventions that isolate and pathologize grief. Keep busy. Be strong. Don't feel bad. Time heals all wounds. Spellbound by the pop psychologizing of grief as an embarrassing affliction, a time-sensitive event, we grieve alone if we grieve at all. We spend more time talking about grief than actually grieving. 9. The times in which we live call for a geographical orientation to grieving that accounts for uncertain origins, unknown ancestry, severed kinship, homelessness, a dislocated sense of place, a bottomless pit of sorrow. 10. Grieve on the daily. Make time every day to grieve. Make grieving out of everyday gestures. Make folding the laundry grieving. Make sweeping the floor grieving. Make dancing grieving. Crying is beneficial but not required. Just say, I am grieving right now. While you are doing whatever you are doing, say what it is you are grieving and be specific. I'm grieving gun violence. I'm grieving another black person killed. I'm grieving black bodies left in the street. I'm still grieving slavery. I'm grieving slaves buried in unmarked graves. I'm grieving the Buffalo massacres. I'm grieving that I stand here on stolen land. I'm grieving hairdressers who keep trying to colonize my hair. I'm grieving my auntie who is dying, but no one will say she is dying. I'm grieving pussy grabbing. I'm grieving the rape of women, my mother, my friends, the little girl that I was before. I'm grieving transphobia. I'm grieving queer and trans people not feeling safe. I'm grieving love being criminalized. I'm grieving 49 dead. Grieve with instead of for.
Angela Hennessy at the first ever Reimagine End of Life. What you heard was an excerpt from her poem. Hear the full version on the Dying to Talk page at kalw.org. Reimagine End of Life returns to San Francisco the week of April 16th. Visit letsreimagine.org to learn more. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross. As a doctor caring for people facing life-threatening illness, I find that the permission to be curious, to grieve, and ultimately to love is at the very heart of my passion for talking about what matters most in life. Dr. Emily Silverman created an event called the Nocturnists as a safe space for healthcare providers to share their own stories, peeling back the curtain on the mysteries of medicine and shining a light on the conflicts that arise as we wrestle with mortality. Two doctors tell the next pair of stories. First up, Dr. Wendy Knapp, who teaches us sometimes the best medicine is when medicine gets out of the way.
I think it was my love of Faulkner rather than Osler that drew me to medicine. It's that narrative that ties us to the patient, to humanity and the universe. It's that story that makes this journey worthwhile to me. So this is a story for you. And that morning when I met Mr. Redfield, I was on telemetry. I was hit in the head with humility and insanity. When I walked in the room, I noticed he was a tall man, taller than the bed even, and it didn't fit him, and he was wiry and awake, and his eyes were on fire, more awake than any 90-year-old man I'd ever met. And I'd had morning sign out. It was 90-year-old man, had two episodes of VTAC the night before. His implanted defibrillator had shocked him back to life. And two episodes the week before as well, and he said, it felt like I was kicked by a horse. Anyway, I had prepared my scripted end-of-life conversation, you know. Oh, Mr. Redfield, the prognosis is poor. You know, your heart is only working at 10%, and we've tried every medication, and, you know, you're 90 years old. The surgery is very risky. But when I saw him, I was intrigued. So I sat down for a moment to spend a little time with the man instead of the disease. He told me a story that reminded me of my Uncle Ross from Arkansas. Uncle Ross, he grew tomatoes as big as softballs, and he kept a shotgun at the back door to guard the tomatoes from two-legged predators. And like Uncle Ross, he was a farmer, and it was in no mood to wax poetic about the good old days. He said there was nothing good about them. They were hard as hell. And he'd been in World War II, and he said that was a long trudge through the muck. He also told me about his family and his wife who had died. And I started to realize that this man, he was prepared to die. And then he said it. I'm done. I'm ready to go. I want to die. Okay. I said, well, so much for my scripted conversation. Mr. Redfield, you can die. Oh, gosh. I was thinking, can I turn that thing off? I think I turned off pacemakers before, but the defibrillator? Can you just turn that thing in his chest off? Mr. Redfield, you can die. Well, let's do it. What do you mean? Well, that thing in your chest, every time it shocks you, it's bringing you back to life. Oh, well, it feels like I'm getting kicked by a horse. I've had enough of it. Today, let's see. Don't you think you should take the night to think about it? We should have a family conference and, you know, I'll talk to your cardiologist. I was thinking, where's the machine? Can I turn this thing off? And he said, no, I want it today. I'm ready. I'm ready to go. So I hedged a little bit. I said, give me a couple hours. How about this afternoon? I've got a couple things I need to take care of before we do this, and I'll be back. Okay, this afternoon. Don't forget. Wagging his finger. So I ran out of the room and sighed, and the nurse's eyes were as big as saucers. He heard the whole conversation. He's like, can you turn that off? And I'm like, I don't know. So I went to the phone, and I called his cardiologist. His cardiologist happened to be out of town, but he said, well, you know, you can turn it off, just like the pacemaker, you get the machine. But I've never done it before. It's like, oh, my God, you've never turned off a defibrillator. I said, well, you probably need an ethics consult. Oh, no, that would be torture. An ethics consult, and it's Sunday, and a family conference. So I fumbled some more, and I tried to find the machine to at least interrogate his AICD and interrogate the pacemaker. It was locked in a closet with the key was with the cardiologist who was out of town. Well, there were others, but so I checked the telemetry strip, and yeah, he was still having VTAC. I called the pacemaker rep, and he happened to be in town surfing. He said, sure, I'll come by. And I walked into the workroom and sat down and took a breath. I said, okay, I'm just going to work on some simple pneumonias and COPD exacerbation. And then I got a page from the ethics committee. I guess the cardiologist had called him. And talked to the ethics committee. Yeah, you better have a family conference, and we'll talk about it, and be sure and document. It's like, okay. So I heard a knock on the door. It was Phil, the pacemaker rep. And he said, I did it. It's done. It's turned off. What? You mean it's off? Yeah, I turned it off. Wait a minute. Oh, my gosh. Can we ask him to turn it back on again? Oh, that would be ridiculous. I can't do that. Phil, look, we're supposed to have an ethics consult, a family conference, all this stuff, and the cardiologist, and I was just talking to them, and he's like, well, I guess we got to talk to him. I'm like, oh, geez. So we rushed Phil and I into the room, and Phil was at the head of the bed smiling, and Mr. Redfield's like, ah. His hair was still wet. Phil. His hair was still wet from the wipeout and the surf, and he had on his board shorts, and I was at the foot of the bed, and Mr. Redfield's feet were, his toes were sticking out from the covers, and he's like, hi. I'm like, hi, Mr. Redfield. You know, do you think we should talk to your family about this? This is a big decision, and maybe they would want to understand what you're doing and your thoughts behind turning this off. He's like, no, it's done. And Phil was over there standing, saying, yeah, it's done, it's done. Yep. I said, but wait a minute. you know, they may be uneasy with you passing away so suddenly when they just brought you here. They thought you were just getting the defibrillator and they're going to fix and you were going to go back home. He said, how will they feel? Well, I don't care. I'll be dead. Well, that's it, isn't it? The pact was between me and the patient, not his cardiologist, not his family, not the ethics committee, not Phil. He was just taking my orders. And despite all my preparation and all my conversation, the stars had aligned for this man in his command. And this man who had plowed 1,000 rows and walked 1,000,000 steps for country and family, took his last step on his own terms. Mr. Redfield died that night in his sleep. It just seems like sometimes we need to respect death, respect the man, step back in awe, and get out of the way.
You're listening to a special broadcast featuring stories from the first ever Reimagine End of Life. That was Dr. Wendy Knapp. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, palliative care specialist and host of KALW's Dying to Talk. If you remember one thing from this program, let it be this. Make your wishes known now while you can. Then let the second thing you remember be that life is uncertain, and we need to live it fully while we can. Dr. Brad Hunter, a cancer specialist, learned about life's unpredictability while discovering what he has in common with the local weathermen.
Have you ever tried to plan your day around getting on your weather app and seeing the 10% chance of rain and then getting soaked? I hate that. I'll watch the Weather Channel and they're up there with their perfect face and their perfect clothes and the perfect map. And then they're wrong. And I'm like, you have weather satellites. You have math, like, help me out. And I gotta say that after spending some time in the ICU, I've gained maybe a kinship for weather forecasters. I was taking care of a gentleman who I'll call Harold, and he's an 80-year-old gentleman who had metastatic cancer just all over his body. And when I would walk into his room every day, the sight that I would see is a man lying in a bed on a ventilator, unresponsive, with lines coming out of his body, and a feeding tube in to give him some sort of sustenance, and on a bunch of blood pressure medicines to keep his blood pressure elevated so that he could survive. And we were giving him fluid at the same time because the blood pressure medicines weren't enough. And so while I had had him under my care, he had gained 50 pounds of water and was just puffy and looked really uncomfortable. And I was uncomfortable taking care of him. You know, I, like all physicians, I had taken the Hippocratic Oath, which talks about doing no harm. And I felt like I was doing Harold harm. And I tried to convey this to his family, that there may be something worse than death, and that might be what we're doing to him. But his family didn't see that. His family saw a fighter, and that was their word. And we hear this all the time, and I think I understand where it comes from, but it's an interesting word. Nobody describes their family member as being not a fighter. Everyone is a fighter, and so you reflect on it, and I got to be honest, I was trying to figure out what we were fighting for. And so as I tried to convey this to his family every day, It wasn't going very well. In fact, his daughter said to me one day, "My father came to me in a dream last night and said, 'You have to believe in me and keep fighting for me because my doctors don't believe in me.'" And I mean, what in the world do you say to that? And so as the conversation continued, one day they brought me aside and they said, "Okay, doc, just tell us, how long does he have left to live?" And this is difficult for a few reasons. One is, a person is not a gallon of milk, so I can't lean over and say, "June 23rd, right? And if you try and guess and you're wrong, that's it. You know, nobody believes you anymore. And if you're vague, nobody likes that. And they just think you don't know what you're talking about. And thinking about it, I thought about weather forecasters, and I thought it was about specifically someone talking about a hurricane. I know where the hurricane is today. We all do. That's easy. And I know where the hurricane's going to be in a month. There's going to be no hurricane. But to figure out how we're going to get from A to B is a little harder. And so they've got that graph, and they draw that white line up the middle, and it's shaded on the sides where the hurricane could go. People don't like the shading. If you're sitting there thinking about whether or not to pack up the kids and go to Memphis, it's just, you don't like the vagueness. And neither do families in the ICU. And so I came in and I said, I think he has days to weeks. They didn't like that. And so I said, you know, what I do know is if we disconnect him from the ventilator, he's gonna just live a couple of hours, based on how he's doing. And so the family thought about that for a while and then decided that they would disconnect him from the ventilator, partly because they were ready, I think, to move on, but a big part of it, I think, was also that they wanted us to show us that we were wrong and that he was a fighter. And so we disconnected him from the ventilator, and he lived. He lived for longer than an hour or two. He lived for 3 days, and then he died. And those first couple of days were really uncomfortable because we were the ones who didn't believe in him, and he had made it, and they were upset with us for how we had felt about him. But in thinking back on it, you know, we weren't wrong. Harold just didn't take the path right up the middle. You know, on doctor shows, they're always right, which is frustrating, that they can sit there and they're like, "This patient has 3 days to live. This patient has 2 months to live," and that's exactly how long they live. But in reality, it's nothing like that. And it's really hard. And so in thinking about how am I going to deal with this in the future, I'm going to be an oncologist. Do I stay vague? Or do I just hazard my best guess? And I come back to the weather chart. I think you have to give somebody the line, but you gotta give them the shaded part too. And you just have to know that some people aren't gonna like that. But I don't think there's a better way to do it. And so in thinking, you know, when I watch the Weather Channel now, I gotta admit, it feels a little bit different now. And I think I feel a little bit less anger, or or maybe the right word is disdain, when I try to plan the perfect picnic and end up getting drenched.
Dr. Brad Hunter on the Nocturnus stage at the first ever Reimagine End of Life. Reimagine returns to San Francisco with more than 150 events from April 16th to the 22nd. Visit letsreimagine.org to see a full schedule. Our final stop is at a Reimagine event called M. Mori, which is short for Memento Mori, an ancient Latin phrase meaning remember your mortality. Here, artists helped audience tap into their own sense of life's wonder by sharing the incredible loss-related backstories and context to their artistic works. Architect Jazz Teagan shares how his design for a temple at Burning Man is a manifestation of a survivor's duty to remember those who have come before us.
I was living in New York City in Brooklyn when the Twin Towers fell. And in the aftermath, I spent a great deal of time at a vigil in Union Square. It was spontaneous and beautiful and heartbreaking. And one day, I came across a wall plastered with flyers. They were missing persons posters placed by the families and loved ones of victims. But unlike the usual posters, there was no mystery behind them. We all knew exactly what had happened. Now, on the face of it, these posters are so obviously a futile act. They're a thing done in service to desperation, to a belief that just maybe fate loves your person as much as you do and has granted some kind of miracle. Maybe she's wandering around the city dazed, maybe she has amnesia, and this poster will somehow bring her home. And it's a fantasy that's so much better than the alternative that at least you must try. On each poster, you would find the identifying details you'd expect, a height and weight and hair color and eye color and what they were last seen wearing, and there was always a number you could call, please call. But if you read on, there were other details too, almost invariably. Here was a father of a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old, and he coached their soccer team on weekends. Here was a daughter who loves to travel, and she's been planning a trip to South America for months. And here, a cousin who's dreamed of being a firefighter since he was 5. For each poster, someone has combed through a collection of photographs to select just the right one. And then someone sat down to choose the words. They were personalizing words, eulogizing words. So for each poster, there's a family that knows the truth, but feels a duty to their denial, a duty to keep hope longer than the rest of us. And so someone makes a poster, makes 100 copies or 1,000, and then walks through the city until walls like this can be found everywhere. So many families, so many different people responding in the same way. And as much as these posters are meant to bring a loved one home, they're also ritual. Standing there, staring at a wall of faces, dead faces, I came to understand all of it very differently. And of course, none of these people came home. Today, you can find their names on a memorial at Ground Zero. They're carved in granite parapets surrounding waterfalls that occupy the footprints of the World Trade Center. And in my mind, everything about that is wrong, because that memorial is about how they died. And the walls of missing posters speaks to how they lived, who they were, that they were. So I can draw a straight line from that wall to a temple in the desert with rituals of its own, where people bring remembrances and personal altars that they've made with their hands, and where they write messages on the structure itself, that what would be graffiti in any other sacred space here becomes the heart and soul of the place. This became our guiding ethos. What were we doing in making this temple? The metaphor we used is that the temple is a book. It's a book with 1,000 authors written by countless hands. It's a book that no one can read in its entirety before it's gone, but you don't need to read far to see the truth that lives there. And it's a book that we write together. It's raw and it's honest and it's real. I believe that the most useful tool in grieving is to recognize and understand that death is not the end of a relationship. It's certainly a permanent and generally undesirable change. It's a hard right turn. But when my parents died, I was deeply comforted to discover that there were still lessons that I could learn from them. In fact, there were lessons that in some cases I was not able to learn until after they were gone. And though those were bittersweet, they are still lessons that are deeply cherished. Finally, in feeling guilt about an unresolved and unreconciled relationship, and this was the most common story you would see from people who were bringing their experiences to the temple, not only do we punish ourselves, often needlessly, we also do a disservice to our loved one and to the love and friendship that exists between us. As the survivor, we have a duty as the memory keeper. We cannot do justice to the essential role when we are letting guilt cast a shadow over all our memories.
We conclude with a story by electronic musician Yoko Kay. It's a fitting conclusion to an artistic community inquiry into death, dying, and the life in between. Here, Yoko asks us to consider what sound we wish to hear at the end of our life.
Several years ago, I got sick, and quite sick, and I had to spend many hours in hospitals. I'm very sensitive to sound, so I was so scared of all the noise around me. Sound of alarms, beeps, doors are getting slammed, people are screaming, phones, pagers, code blue. Lying on a hospital bed, I used to wonder, you know, some people say hearing is the last sense to go when we die. So what is the last sound I get to hear at the end of my life? Is it like this? Unnecessary noise is the cruelest absence of care. Nightingale said more than 100 years ago, sound matters. It has profound impact on our sense of well-being and sense of dignity. After the illness, I felt like this part of my life is a bonus, like a gift with which I kind of get to do anything. So I started an initiative to transform our way of thinking about sound environment in healthcare. I started to work with Johns Hopkins Medicine, Sibley Memorial Hospital's Innovation Hub. We created tranquility room for people to be able to calm, relax with customized sound. We are working with Oncology Center to bring the nature sound that's tied to the local ecology. Part of my initiative is to explore this question with the Open IDEO community, which is, what is the last sound you wish to hear at the end of your life? Conversations were very intimate and profound, like with Morgan, who said she's oftentimes a part of this intimate and difficult process of liberating someone from a ventilator, with the expectation that the life thereafter of this person will be very short. Since she read this idea on Open IDEO, her team started to play a meaningful piece of music moments before the person's death. And she said, this has impacted everyone in our palliative care unit tremendously. I wanted to have more conversations like that, so I took the idea to Stanford Medicine X to record the voices of people sharing stories around the last sound they wish to hear. The artists of Burning Man, the temple builders, were talking about this cathartic experience, making art with community, the importance of holding space and empowering the community. And the conversations are often very vulnerable. And oftentimes I wondered, you know, this is the conference that's about the future of medicine. And it's about this battle against this disease, and we are supposed to be winning all the time. And here I am asking people about their death. Am I like pooping this party? You know, am I imposing this question, this unsettling question? Is it really necessary? Thinking about this scary thing together can transform the way we think about our lives. So now I like to invite all of us to, just for a moment, close our eyes and reflect together and reimagine what is the last sound we wish to hear at the end of our lives.
I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, and I hope you've enjoyed these stories, poems, and music highlights from the first ever Reimagine End of Life. More than that, I hope you've become inspired to engage further. Reimagine End of Life returns to San Francisco from April 16th to the 22nd, including events featuring Oscar winners Frances McDormand and Coco director Lee Unrich. RSVPs are required, and the majority of the events are free. Visit letsreimagine.org for a complete schedule and tickets. This program was produced at the studios of KALW in San Francisco. Ted Muldoon is the sound designer, and Matt Martin is the advising producer. Special thanks to Brad Wolf, catalyst for Reimagine End of Life, and to all the event producers, hosts, sponsors, and performers. Thank you for your vision, courage, and artistry.
The last sound I want to hear at the end of life is the first sound I heard at the beginning of life.
The last sound I wish to hear in my life would be a gentle breeze through the trees.
Or being on a mountainside and hearing the wind go past.
The ocean waves hitting the beach.
The crash of waves.
The water.
Why do you think water?
It's life. It's movement.
It's transformative.
Genetically calming. I think we've slept by water.
It's like their happy place.
So the last thing I want to hear before I die would be, I love you. It's kind of cheesy, but that's probably one of the best sounding things I could think of right now.